Okay, I want to, before switching into processes and scheduling, I want to talk about the slab allocator, which is one of the papers for nominally last week. And I'm sure that the schedule at this point is going to slip another day before it starts to recover, and then we'll get back on the syllabus. But I want to cover this both because it's a really phenomenal piece of engineering and also because it relates to your first project assignment, which is to implement it. And more on that tonight. We tend to think in terms of general purpose utilities. Right? We imagine that if we're going to do balanced tree, kind of an object, it's going to be a general balanced tree object. Right? And if we contemplate specializing that, we do so in the style of templates. Right? So we'll build a generic binary tree implementation, and we'll rely on the compiler to specialize it for types where it can be done particularly efficiently. And this is one of these cases where there's a conflict of priorities between reuse and encapsulation on the one hand and performance on the other. And the reason you build a general B-tree class is, hey, a B-tree is actually hard to get right. Anybody who's built one of them can tell you that. By the way, if you don't do the delete operation, they're much easier, and that's why most of the tech folks don't tell you how to do the delete operations, because most of the authors don't know. But if you've ever built one of these things, you know, after the first time you say, holy crud, this was hard, I don't want to ever do this again, I'm going to do a general version. I can tell you from experience it doesn't work that way, because you thought it was general, and it never turns out to be general, but you figure you'll save some work, and you'll abstract away some detail, like in the B-tree case, you need a total ordering on the member objects, right? So you'll abstract away the notion of less than or less than or equal to, and pretty soon you have a piece of code that you might well reuse in lots of circumstances, but you got it at the cost of a significant loss of performance. And one might argue that on modern processors you shouldn't care. That one of the reasons that you have, you know, 10,000 times the memory speed that you had 10 years ago or 20 years ago is so that you can afford to waste those extra cycles. I don't buy it. And the reason I don't buy it is all those cycles are actually going someplace. They're going into changes in user interface. If you look at the user interfaces that people are working with today versus the stuff they worked with in the 1980s, it's like night and day. And there's stuff being done now in user interfaces that you wouldn't have contemplated because you didn't have the confidants to run them. You didn't have the memory bandwidth to run them. So in spite of the story that you want to build general code, it's also the case that you want to specialize code. If it's a 10% difference, I don't know if it's worth it. Depends on what the application is. But if it's a factor of two difference, now it's an interesting problem. The other factor to consider is as the code gets closer to the bottom of the system, this cost becomes harder and harder to amortize away because it gets imposed over a larger and larger part of the system. If I double the overhead of the operating system, right? All that time is gone permanently. There's nothing the application can do to be clever someplace else to make the time up. So one of the things that turns out to be very expensive is memory allocation. And there are two reasons for that. One is that finding a block of memory that's appropriate for the object you want is intrinsically expensive in most implementations, in the general implementations. But the other is, think about what you do immediately after you find the block of memory. You initialize it. Now the good news is that the initialization code is done with writes. And a really smart code generator can probably do a reasonable job of managing the cache for those writes. But on modern caches, you might think so, but on modern caches, it turns out if you load something and you modify it, and later you need to load something else in the same location, well, the cache has delayed writing the previous information back to memory. So even if you don't actually need to go back out to memory to fetch something, you may need to go back out to memory to clear out the current contents of the cache before you can reuse that part of the cache line. So cache effects are actually incredibly important here. So the thing to notice is, oh, and by the way, when you tear the object down, right, just before you free, what are you going to do? You're going to destruct the object. You're going to do a lot of memory references to the object for the sole purpose of throwing it away. Which actually doesn't make a lot of sense when you think about it. So, the idea of the slab allocator is, in essence, to treat both of these activities in a way that's a little specialized for the needs of a kernel. So one of the patterns you observe in a kernel is very often the conditions that you establish when you destroy the object are the same as the conditions that you need after you reinitialize the object. For example, when you allocate the object, you want to know that its doubly linked list pointers are in a well-defined initialized state. Turns out that state for the doubly linked list pointers is probably the same state as when the element isn't on a list. Because think about it, when you allocate the object, you don't want it on a list, and then the next thing you're going to do is stick it on a list, so you want those pointers to be in the not currently on a list state. When you delete the object, it better not be on a list, right? If it's still on a list when you delete it, something's wrong. And so with high likelihood, those pointers are going to be in the not currently on a list state. So the idea is, why do the word twice? If you know enough to know that the destroyed state of the object is the same as the initialized state of the object, then maybe what you can do is you can arrange at the time you free the object to leave it in the state that you'll need if you later allocate the object again. Just avoiding an extra step. Okay. So another way to say that is, we're now going to have a two-layer memory allocation system, right? The bottom layer is something vaguely like what you imagine malloc and free do. It really gets rid of things in the heap. The layer above that is going to provide a cache of properly initialized objects. Now, what we're going to do is, when we need an object, we're going to go to the cache. If there's nothing in the cache, we're going to go get some honest-to-God memory and we're going to initialize it. When we free an object, we're going to deinitialize it back to its initial condition, but we're going to leave it in the cache in this initialized condition in the hope that we'll get to reuse it successfully. However, the cache is broken up into chunks. And as a unit, if we run short of memory, these chunks can be reclaimed. Okay. So here's the way this works conceptually. For each type of object, I'm going to introduce a new cache. So if I have a foo object, I'm going to have a cache that only knows how to allocate foo objects. And this cache is going to have an initialization procedure for the objects, and it's going to have a deinitialization procedure. That's the one where I'm freeing the object. I don't think that they called it a deinitialization procedure. What term did they use? Might as well get consistent terms. Destructor. And I'm going to supply these procedures at the time that I create the cache. This cache is going to consist of a bunch of chunks. And inside these chunks, I'm going to put the objects. So, as far as the malloc and free layer is concerned, these chunks of cache are the unit of allocation. So when I'm actually allocating memory, I'm always grabbing one of these chunks. And these chunks are called slabs. So the idea is a cache consists of some number of slabs. When a cache is empty and I need more objects, I go, I grab another slab, I initialize each of the objects in this slab because everything in the slab is of the same type. I add it to the cache, now I have a new pool of available objects, and I go ahead and allocate. When I release objects, I, with some likelihood, in some of the time, I will discover, hey, I've just released the last object in a slab. If all of the objects in a slab are released, the slab as a whole can be reclaimed. So we're not partitioning memory based on the size of the object we're allocating. We're partitioning memory based on the type of the object that we're allocating. We're doing a type-specific allocator. So what happens here is that I believe in the implementation that actually lives at the end of each slab. There's a slab, what's called a slab header. For reasons of alignment, the header actually lives at the end. It's really a slab trailer. And the headers are linked into the cache structure. So when I allocate a cache, or it initially has no slabs, when I go to the cache to allocate an object, the first thing it does is allocate a slab. And the rule is that on this linked list, slabs that have available free unallocated objects, you always arrange for them to go to one side of the cache. So this is a double linked list with the added constraint that active slabs move to the front or the back of the list. Pick one. Why? Because if you free an object in a slab, you would like to reallocate an object from the same slab for reasons of cache locality. Because you already know you've got a free object, it's sitting there, it's hot, it's ready to be reallocated, and you'd like to use it. Okay. Well, not quite. We're not actually going to play the linked list game. Let me set that aside for a second. What's the size of this slab? One of the things that's important in an allocator is to not have excessive fragmentation. So you choose the size of the slab as a function of two things. One, the size of the object it contains. And two, the size of all the other slabs. So let me explain this. There's a lower bound that's imposed by the object size and the amount of overhead you're willing to accept. The magic number in the slab allocator is 12.5%. So if I'm trying to allocate, slabs in turn are always a multiple of pages. So this is a unit that's going to get allocated in kernel virtual memory. We're going to go out, we're going to get real pages to back it, and we're going to find some contiguous region of the virtual memory in the kernel, and we're going to arrange that those virtual page addresses will point to these physical pages. So the slab is always a multiple of page size, some number of pages.
When you say adjacent, you mean physically adjacent?
No, I mean virtually adjacent.
I don't think you've spoken about this yet. When you say kernel memory space, we're talking about the last gigabyte of every process, or does the kernel have its own 4K window?
You're right, I haven't talked about that. So let me fudge whether I'm talking about kernel memory, although I'm talking about a kernel allocator, so I'm going to have to come back to that point. So what I have to do is I have to allocate, I have to build a slab basically where if one page is good enough, fine. Right? But I could get into a situation where if I only allocate one page, then somehow, given my object size, right, I'll have some number of objects that actually fit in the page, and then I'll have some leftover space. And the leftover space could turn out to be acceptable, and it could turn out to be that it will destroy my fragmentation requirement. Right? If I had a 2100 byte object, and I have a 4 kilobyte page size, if I allocate just one page per slab, I'm going to have a fragmentation of almost 50%. If I allocate a 2-page slab, I'm going to end up at about 20%, still above my threshold. Some number of pages later, I'm going to find that I've got a fit that actually works. And the magic number often turns out to be 3 or 4 or 5 pages in practice because of the sizes of objects that we tend to be working with. Now, there's another factor in choosing a slab size. Think about what's happening in your virtual memory. Okay? You have windows in this virtual memory where you're going to allocate these slabs. There are two senses in which you can deallocate a slab. The first is you can say, well, I'm decommitting a 5-page slab. Why would I be decommitting it? Because I need the storage for something else. But it could turn out the something else also needs a 5-page slab. And then you're fine. But suppose the something else only needs a 4-page slab. So then what's going to happen is you're going to decommit this 5-page slab, and you're going to get left with this 1-page hole. And now what we're seeing is fragmentation in the virtual address space. And the slab allocator does suffer from this, and there's some ad hoc mechanisms that are used to sort of recover from it. And one of the ad hoc mechanisms is to say, look, even if I don't really need it, it's not worth allocating a 1-page slab. I'm just going to set a lower bound on my slab size. This is an ad hoc lower bound. I'm going to say 4 pages, or 3 pages, or 5 pages, probably 4 pages. And this has the effect that very few of my slabs will be of any other size. So it's kind of like all pages are interchangeable because they're all the same size. At least all the 4-page slabs now are interchangeable because they're all the same size. And what you'll find is that there aren't enough of the other slabs for the fragmentation to actually get you in practice. Well, how do I find free objects? So I have the slabs, I've got the objects initialized, how do I know what's free? The slab allocator divides objects into two categories, large objects and small objects. And the reason small objects are different is both for reasons of storage and also for reasons of sort of making this system ground out. If I'm talking about a large object, then what's going to happen is there's going to be something called a buff tuttle structure. And the buff tuttle structure points to the object and slab has a pointer to the buff tuttles associated with that slab. So the buff kernels are kept in a linked list. And an object is either free or it's allocated. And if it's free, it has one of these buff kernel structures. And I don't remember whether the buff kernel structure is also there if it's allocated. I think the answer is it should be. But I don't know what they actually, I don't remember what they actually did. Well, if the objects are big, this buff kernel structure is okay. It's basically a two-word structure. It's two pointers, right? A linked list, it's a forward linked list pointer, and it's a pointer to the object that is available for allocation. Well, where do the buff kernel structures come from? Well, they come from the cache for buff kernels. And that cache consists of some number of slabs whose objects are these buff kernels. You can see the reductio problem coming. Because the next video is going to be, well, how do I know which of these buff kernels are free? Right? And the answer, well, I have buff kernels that point to them, is going to quickly get us in trouble. At this point, the slab allocator cheats. It says, look, there's a threshold object size below which it doesn't make sense to allocate a separate buff kernel structure. If I'm trying to manage a two-word object, allocating a second two-word object to remember whether the first two-word object was free is stupid. Furthermore, if I'm allocating a two-word object, look, the cost of reinitializing the first couple of words, even if it's a four-word object, suppose I say, look, every time I allocate a small object, I'm going to have to reinitialize the first couple of words. Okay. That's still cheaper than indirecting through a buff kernel object. So here's the way this works. For small objects, there are no buff kernels. And what happens is the object, when it is free, acts as its own buff kernel. So in this case, if we were to look at the small object, what we would discover is that the entire object is of type foo. But when the object is free, we're going to pretend that the beginning of the object is actually a buff kernel. Well, now we're going to cheat further. Notice that in this two-word buff kernel structure, one of the words existed to provide a pointer to the start of the object. Right? But if the start of the buff kernel is the start of the object, we hardly need this extra pointer. We've already got it. If we've got a pointer in the buff kernel, we've already got the pointer we want. So we're going to chop that extra pointer out of the buff kernel. Okay? And we're going to say, oh, well, this is really a small object buff kernel. It's just the next pointer. And at this point, there are two reasonable choices. I don't know which one the slab allocator used. I don't remember. I'm sorry, I didn't have time to reread the paper fully this morning. But I know which one I personally prefer. Really, what we need here is a next pointer. And there are two ways I could do that. One is that I could say, well, I will leave the bits of the foo object unmolested, so that I don't have to mess with them. And I will arrange to prepend a next one. Actually, the three ways to do it. The next strategy will work.
By seeking the buffer cutter inside the object, aren't you forced to reinitialize it later?
I'm forced to reinitialize those words that the buffer cutter occupy. Yes. And that's part of why I'm saying, actually, I'd really prefer not to overwrite the buffer cutter. So, I still don't need the object pointer, because there's now still a constant relationship between the address of this next pointer field and the address of the object. And I know this constant relationship because I know what the object type, because I know how big a pointer is. What's the problem if I put the next field at the beginning? Where am I going to get sandbag? It's actually a fairly large problem. If I get a malloc and I say I want 64 bytes, are there any constraints on the pointer that malloc can legally return to me? Obviously, it has to be free space. We hope. Anybody who's actually used malloc for any length of time will soon discover that it's not always return free space, but when it doesn't, it's usually your fault. What other constraints are there on this pointer that comes back?
It
has to be a line. What does that mean? It's on a what byte boundary?
4 byte.
Why is 4 byte boundary matter? By the way, you're assuming a 32-bit machine, but let's run with that for a minute. Why is 4 bytes magic? On many machines,
most processors can load non-multiple of 4 bytes.
Well, sure they can. They load characters all the time. You're on the right track, but that's not quite a right statement of the problem.
Yes, that maybe it can. If you, by assuming that by requiring everything to line to 4 bytes, you can chop off a portion of the instruction, and therefore you can have the instruction at the beginning and the address at the end in the assembly.
So you think there may be some encoding advantage in the instruction set? I guess that's plausible. It turns out that's not what's going on, and one way to see that that would not be what was going on is to think that there's sometimes when I'm going to do a load, but the pointer I want is in a register. So actually the pointer value usually is not encoded, often at least, is not encoded in the instruction itself. So it's not an encoding issue. You're actually on the right track here. So processor,
you can't load int from an unaligned boundary.
Okay, what does it mean for an int to be in an unaligned boundary?
It means that starts at some non-multiple of 4.
More precisely, it starts at some address that's not a multiple of the size of an int. Because an int might not be a 32-bit quantity. On an AMD 64, it might be a 64-bit quantity. And on that machine, you want it to be 64-bit aligned. Right, so the data types that are manipulated by the hardware all have the property that there's some power of 2 in size. And for the most part, and there are notable exceptions for legacy reasons involving floating point, but at least for the integral types, most processors, if you attempt to load an integral quantity from an address that is not naturally aligned, you will take an exception. And on a 32-bit machine, it turns out that the largest such data type is an int, which is 4 bytes. Long is not, on a 32-bit machine, the long is 64 bits, long is not a data type known to the hardware. It's a construct implemented by the compiler. On a 64-bit machine where the natural word size is 64 bits, you're going to have a hardware instruction that loads a 64-bit quantity, and that instruction is going to require natural alignment on main processors. And it turns out, almost universally, that the register size is the data register size on modern machines is always the same as the pointer size. So it turns out that if you have an arbitrary structure, I'm getting ahead of myself. So it turns out if you're aligned to a pointer boundary, you're okay for all of the hardware types of machine. Now let me tell you about the exceptions. On the RS6000, they made a nearly fatal design mistake. They said, oh, this alignment, this natural alignment rule is good. We should do it for floating point values as well. It's a 32-bit machine, but when you load a 64-bit floating point value on that machine, it has to be loaded at a 64-bit address. Oh boy, was this a mistake. From a hardware designer's perspective, this was unquestionably the right thing to do. And let me point out why. Suppose that the data type is not naturally aligned, then you can get a situation where the object you're loading in hardware might span a page boundary. I can name 4 processors off the top of my head that did not implement the alignment restriction, that had bugs related to page fault handling in this case. Specifically, if you page faulted on the second page, but not on the first, you'd get half of a load. And what's striking about that error is how many processor implementers independently implemented this bug. It's hard to get right. So the RS6000 guy said, well, that's really stupid. We shouldn't do that. I mean, the answer is if it's hard and it's error prone and it's not necessary, don't do it. Is it necessary? Unfortunately, there was this machine called the VAX. The VAX is a 32-bit machine that had the following property. If you looked at its floating point unit, what you would discover is that a double precision floating point register, a 64-bit floating point register, was actually implemented in the machine as 2 single precision floating point registers, so you could name these registers by 2 names. When you loaded a double precision floating point register, you were actually loading 2 registers. So the way this actually looks on this machine is you have a double wide register file. Like this. And the real implementation is that you didn't do a double floating point load. You did 2 single floating point loads, but you did them into adjacent registers, knowing that what was going on was, look, the load instruction doesn't care that it's a floating point value. It's a 32-bit thing, right? You're moving 32 bits from memory into a register. How you interpret those 32 bits depends on what instructions you subsequently run. If you run single precision floating point instructions, you'll get either the left half or the right half according to which floating point register you access. If you run double precision floating point instructions, you'll get both halves at the same time. So really what's going on is the machine has 2 register sets in the floating point unit instead of even registers instead of odd numbered registers. And it's able to access them either way. There was an unfortunate consequence of this, which was that in that implementation, it's not natural to say to the compiler, hey, double precision values have to be 64-bit aligned, because after all, in memory, they're not really 64-bit values. It's synthetic. Now that would have been okay. Except then there was a thing called Fortran. And Fortran proceeded to use this property in the following way. Fortran has something called a common area. And one of the ways that you're allowed to break the type system in Fortran, and it turns out it's occasionally important to do this in Fortran, is you can declare in two separate files the data types of the globals. You can declare what are called overlays. And you can in one file say, hey, I have a floating point value here at this location. In another file, you would say, hey, I have a 30-qubit integer here at this location. By doing that, you can do integer manipulations on floating point operands in memory. And there are Fortran programs that rely on this. So what happened when the RS-6000 introduced this constraint is they discovered that they could not compile the majority of existing Fortran code. Because the code at the source level had an embedded dependency on the alignment, a misalignment, of double precision values. So sorry about the long digression, but it's sort of, there are a lot of interacting issues when you make these design decisions. So with the notable exception of the RS-6000, on most modern machines, if you were aligned to the integer register size, that's the worst case alignment you're ever going to have to deal with. On the RS-6000, in fact, which is 32-bit, Malloc has to return a 64-bit aligned result because of this double precision issue. Because if the first thing in your structure is a double, that double must be naturally aligned. And the only way to guarantee that is to return to you always a pointer that is appropriately aligned. Because Malloc doesn't know what you need to use this story for. So there's another possible implementation of this. Because now what we're saying is we're going to have to tack an extra two words onto the front end structure. And at that point, we might as well go back to buff codes. The other possible implementation of this is to say, oh, wait a minute, hang on, there's something else we know that we can exploit here. We know what the size of the type is. We know what the size of foo is. So one thing that we could do is we could say, ah, here's the foo. And the reason I don't want to put anything in front of it is I really don't want to mess with the alignment properties of the foo, whatever they may be. So what I'm going to do instead, I'll put the next pointer above the foo. How's that going to work? Well, think about the link chain. Now what's happening is the link chain pointer coming in points there, right? How am I going to get the foo pointer from that? Well, I'm going to subtract. And I know what subtract to do because I know what the size of the foo object is. All that stuff about safe pointers, not the memory allocator. This is one of the places where actually pointer safety has to be violated. It's one of the dirty corners that safe language designers don't like to talk about. Okay, so what did they actually do? Well, the slide allocator actually chose this implementation with the next pointer at the end. And it's because of the alignment issues. Not the alignment issues you might think. Turns out there's another alignment issue. very often you'll discover that the objects are a nice multiple of the cache line. You'll also discover, and this is an empirical observation, the vast majority of references to an object are to the first few words in the object. If you have a 64-byte object, the first 8 to 16 bytes are going to chew up almost all of the accesses. Why? Well, in a kernel, there are idiomatic reasons. Very often, you have some kind of a representation pipe. You have a list head at the front of the object. That list head tends to get manipulated a lot. The other is just a human factors issue. If I ask you to list out the fields in the structure, you're naturally going to write down the most important ones first. What are the most important ones? The ones you're going to access most. It's just a human issue. Now, because of that, think about the way that this foo is going to lay out in a cache line. So here's my line in the cache. If I put the word at the front, right, I've got typically a 32 to 64 byte cache line, depending on my hardware.
Very close.
Yeah.
What is a cache line?
Come back. I've got a 32 to 64 byte thing that I've got to overlay this structure on. If I spend the first 4 bytes of that on the next pointer, and then I start the foo, and it works out to be bigger than a cache line, what's going to happen is it's going to run into the next one, and now I'm going to touch more than one cache line. In effect, what's happening if I put the next pointer at the front is the first word of the cache line is entirely wasted. Okay, what's a cache line? Properly speaking, that's a question for CSF, but here's the quick answer. In real hardware systems, memory is too slow. So we build a faster memory in front of it. When we go to access a memory location, we actually pull a chunk of memory into this faster memory. So the faster memory is not managed in terms of bytes. It's managed in terms of lines. And when you reference a byte, what actually happens is this fast memory in the cache says, do I have the byte? If not, I'll go to the slow memory, I'll get an entire line worth of bytes, I'll pull them into the fast memory, and then I'll ask you to look again.
Yeah.
So the cache isn't normally addressable?
The cache is only implicitly addressable. So logically, what the application sees is a uniform memory space. Because of caching effects, that memory space has non-uniform latency. So anything you can reference that's in the cache is a factor of 10 to 1,000 faster than anything that's in main memory. And that's why data layout matters. Data layout matters so much that choice of representation is often more important than choice of algorithm. The problem is, because they're fast, because of the engineering limits that make them fast, the engineering properties that make them fast, caches also tend to be relatively small. So just to calibrate this, the first level data cache is almost universally 64 kilobytes. In fact, on some processors, it's even smaller than that. So Jochen Linke used to point out that people used to say, oh, memories are getting bigger. And Jochen would say, no, no, the memories are not getting bigger. What's happening is we're adding more and more forms of fancy tertiary storage. In fact, if you look at the machine, if you say memory is the stuff that operates at about the same speed as the processor, and you look at the machines people were building in the 70s and 80s, you discover the magic number, as soon as the silicon just sort of came up to stability, the magic number was you got 64 kilobytes of memory that ran at the same speed as your CPU. If you look at a modern machine, you discover the magic number is you get 64 kilobytes of memory that runs at the same speed as your CPU. Everything else is backing store. When you put in multiple gigabytes of main memory in your machine, yes, it's faster than disk, it's noticeably slower than cache, like a factor of 100 to 1,000.
But if we keep having the size of transistors, why can't we fit more transistors in the same die area?
It's not a problem of transistors in die area. It's a problem of decoding. So here's the issue. In order to look up a cache line, I've got to do a match on the address. And the question is, how many matches can I do simultaneously? And the answer is, well, that's a binary tree kind of a decision. I have to build a binary tree to do the matching, to do the select. Right? So I'm going to go to my cache and say, here's an address, And I'm going to choose some bits, I'm going to address it to the cache, I'm going to get some set of lines, and then I'm going to select of those lines the one I actually want. The problem is that that select involves a binary tree of logic. And that binary tree of logic is essentially, it's a temporally, causally sequential binary tree of gates. Each of these gates involves a certain amount of delay. So the number of sequential steps of gates determines my clock cycle on the machine. It turns out, for reasons having nothing to do with what I just said, that a typical arithmetic logic unit, an integer add unit, okay, involves what's called five gate delays. You can implement all of the conventional integer operations in five gates. This is what sets the clock speed on your machine. So everything else has to be engineered to five gate delays. And the reason 64 kilobytes is magic is a somewhat longer story, but the summary answer is, above 64 kilobytes, I need another gate delay. So if I want to go to 128, it's going to take me 6 gate delays. And if I go to 6 gate delays, now the cache will slow the machine down instead of speeding the machine up. Okay, so really important to get good utilization out of the cache, and therefore firmly undesirable to chew up 4 bytes of a 32-byte cache line with this damn next pointer that you're not going to use. Okay, one other thing I want to throw in here. This is not strictly necessary, but it's useful. Well, now we have a story for big objects that are pointed to by bus cars and small objects that are self-matching. There's an interesting third case. The third case is, what about the buff cuddles themselves? So observe that when a buff cuddle is free, it has no useful initialized state. Whenever we allocate one, we're going to change both of its pointers, and it's only got two. Because we're going to stick it in a linked list, that's going to change the next pointer, and it's got to point to something. And that's all the pointers it's got. So pragmatically, it is useful in the implementation to implement three types of slab. Large object slabs, small object slabs, and buff cuddle slabs. And the buff cuddles are just handled specially. So for small objects, we're trying to get the storage savings. But for buff cuddle objects, we don't even want the extra next one. One other piece of this. I'm just about done. If you think about what's going on in this slab, the story is we're going to get a certain number of objects, and then we're going to get a header at the end, right? And the header is sort of mandatory. But before the header, we're going to get a junk area. The junk area is the fragmentation. You might think that the right thing to do is to leave the junk area at the end. It's not. Just like the vast majority of references happen to the first few words of an object, it turns out the vast majority of references happen to the first few words of a page. And the consequence of that is that those lines in the cache that correspond to start of page see inordinately high load, enough so that hardware designers have looked at something called a victim cache to offset that load. And I'll be happy to talk about that in an extra session if anybody really cares about caches. So what happens if you put all the extra space in the front? Why would you do that? Well, then my objects are all nicely aligned and they all start at offset zero in the slab and they all are at nice multiples. Cool. So now what happens is all of the objects at a given type are going to lay out in the cache exactly the same way. That means they're going to compete in the cache in exactly the same way. And not only are they going to compete with other objects at the same time, which, by the way, is essentially not avoidable. they're going to compete with all other objects because the slabs have a common alignment factor. So my through object is going to start, the first through object of the slab is going to start at starting pinch. The second through object, the bar object, is also going to start at a starting pinch. For small objects, there isn't a lot you can do about this. If the object is less than the cache line, there's just not much you can do. For large objects, notice there's an interaction between the start of page effect and the start of object effect. So, here's the observation. If you have a fragmentation region that's of any non-trivial size, so if it's 4 bytes, it's not going to help you, no problem. Suppose you have 128 bytes. You don't want to put it all in the end. If it's more than one cache line worth, what you want to do is say, I'm going to take the view that this junk space is some number n of cache lines. And now I'm going to make a randomization decision. I can do this pseudo-randomly, so I can do it cheaply. I'm going to take that n, I'm going to put some of them, I'm going to leave some of them at the end, but I'm going to put some of them at the beginning. Okay, so what I'm going to do is, I'm going to bias where the first slot starts by some randomly selected number of cache lines. And the reason I'm going to do this is then when I allocate the objects, and those objects do hot references on the first few lines of the objects, those hot references will not compete in the cache. And that's a factor of 40% in overall systemic performance. All right. I want you to now go back and reread the slab allocator paper for two reasons. One, it will make more sense now. And two, you're about to implement a slab allocator. Okay. Tomorrow I'll start in on processes, and I will try to get project assignment 1 out tonight.